Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on politics of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me on the roundtable this week is Julie Carr Smythe, state government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Welcome back, Julie.
Good morning.
Sarah Donaldson, a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hey, happy Monday.
And Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Laura.
Good to be here.
So I wanted to start with the latest news from Intel. Central Ohio was already rattled in late July by news of a slowdown at the massive chip-making complex under construction in New Albany. Then, late last week, President Trump called for the CEO to resign over alleged communist ties. Now, Sarah, Intel is very important for Ohio. The state has invested a lot of money in this. What's reaction been like to hearing from the president getting involved with this company?
Well, it's kind of been mixed because you've seen President Trump's allies like Senator Bernie Moreno also call on the CEO, Lip-Bu-Tan, to resign. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel, I was going to say John Husted, that's like, what, six, nine months ago at this point? Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel and Governor Mike DeWine have been still more defensive of Intel and the project. They say that, you know, concrete's going in the ground. This has been kind of a tough political football for some folks who really heralded this project when it was first announced. Going back to Governor Mike DeWine, Lieutenant Governor John Husted, who, you know, was a big part of announcing this project. And of course, our former senators like Senator Sherrod Brown, they helped get CHIPS Act funding to Intel. So now you've got a situation where Intel initially was saying at the start that they would be online by 2025. It's 2025 and the project is nowhere near complete. The latest we've heard from the February timeline slowdown was maybe 2030, 2031, and the state disbursed hundreds of millions of grants to Intel that Intel was under contract to be providing these jobs and providing these employment opportunities by 2027. So you're kind of in this weird holding pattern right now. I mean, Governor Mike DeWine has told me before that, you know, they're going to cross that bridge about clawing back money when they get there. But Intel has a lot of grants to build this project, and it has continuously delayed it.
Yeah, Julie, what do you make of President Trump getting involved here? I mean, Intel seems like Ohio's project, but Intel's a huge company. It's everywhere. So I'm sure there's a lot of political weight in this, too.
Right. I mean, I guess I see this, if we take the Ohio lens on it, it's almost like this tough diplomacy of the Trump administration. This, you know, let's badger people who are sort of we're working with to try to move them versus like the DeWine Tressel approach of these are our friends. We're all just tackling whatever it is that their problems are and trying to come to solutions. So I just see it as a microcosm of the whole way that the Trump administration is handling issues where things aren't going the way they want them to go. You know, sort of triggering that China meme or whatever is also, you know, maybe works in their favor in sense of issues they want to keep on the top of people's minds.
Yeah. And Laura, what's your take on the way Ohioans have been responding to this? I mean, Sarah mentioned that Governor DeWine tries to be optimistic. I mean, can he be anything but?
I mean, if you go on Reddit, people are not as optimistic as Governor DeWine. The question is, I mean, the stuff that was uncovered about the CEO of Intel's, you know, he has through an investment company he owns, super close ties with the People's Liberation Army, like in terms of investments over in China. And it's very interesting. I mean, it's like really interesting. It was dug up by Reuters. It's very interesting. But the question is, how does Ohio play into that? Was Ohio going to get delayed anyway, even if we had gotten a CEO who isn't, you know, this particular investor? Because Ohio's the project for Ohio is already on, you know, it was already delayed. Or, you know, the allegations are that he could be playing Intel in such a way to benefit the other companies that he has an interest in. And so that's kind of the general allegations, which is why, you know, President Trump and others want him to resign. But so I don't know, like, now that we know all of this, I don't really know whether, you know, this is delaying the Ohio project, or the Ohio project is just delayed because Intel's in a lot of trouble anyway.
Yeah, and remember, yeah, he's a new CEO since earlier this year, so that we've already seen upheaval at Intel over some of the things that have held up the Ohio project.
I'm forgetting the first CEO's name.
Pat Gelsinger.
That's the one we actually, like, he came here, he was with President Biden, he ate Fran DeWine's cookies, right?
Yes. And Laura brings a really good point to the table, and I think that the latest focus on Lip Bhutan's financial ties to China are in a way separate from the fact that Intel has been facing economic headwinds for years. Intel is not winning when it comes to the chips market. It's getting beat out by, and our country is getting beat out by other countries, including China. So, you know, Lip Bhutan inherited what Intel is, but Intel was already not doing well. And that's part of the reason that Reuters and other national outlets have reported, you know, Pat Gelsinger stepped down, but it was a little bit of a maybe push. And Gelsinger, you know, did throw a lot of weight behind the Ohio project. You're now talking about a new CEO who's coming in with a new vision. So there are, of course, a lot of questions.
Yeah,
there.
he could be like, why did we do this? Right? Like, why do we have a $28 billion plant in the middle of Ohio?
Right. And I think that the backdrop there is we're trying to onshore chip manufacturing and take it back from Asia, not take it back, but, you know, it's all begun there, and they hold such a large thing. And that's what the CHIPS Act is all about.
The Wall Street Journal last week reported that some high executives at Intel were about to present a plan to get Intel out of the actual manufacturing of chips business so that we'd be only a seller of chips. So if that's the case, that's really bad news for Ohio, because Ohio is literally going to be a manufacturing hub.
And from your story, Sarah, we have Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel. Here's some comments that he made about this.
Maybe some people have more information than others, but based upon the information I have, and I've been out there, I've seen the work they're doing, I know nothing that tells me that their intentions aren't good.
So Jim Tressel's basically saying, you know, he's not in the room where these decisions are being made.
And that was in reference to Senator Bernie Moreno's comments, because Moreno said something along the lines of, on Twitter, that it was clear that Intel had not fulfilled its commitments to Ohio. That's a stronger statement than we've heard from a lot of Ohio officials up until this point. I mean, I think the furthest Governor DeWine has gone has said he's disappointed in the timeline delay. But I mean, you know, this has been reported extensively by local outlets, by national outlets. This is a pretty extensive timeline delay. And at this point, there are concerns about whether this project moves forward. Very real concerns beyond the folks who are out in Licking County, who have seen farmland get sold, who have seen, you know, kind of upheaval of the road system. There's construction trucks everywhere. And now suddenly that's just all slowing down.
We had one of the Reuters reporters who's been working on this, Max Cherney, was on Tech Tuesday last week. And he was talking about some of the things that he uncovered. And one thing that I found very interesting was that he said that Intel is making chips that customers need, but struggling with the making of the chips that customers need, right? And they're not making them fast enough. And so that goes back to Intel as a company, Julie, right? They're having a hard time.
Right. And I mean, this is proprietary technology. You have to know how to make it to make it. And those who have developed the technology and know a lot about it aren't necessarily going to play ball and just share that with you. You have to come up with your own technology. So, you know, maybe they're having more of a struggle than they think. And like Laura says, maybe they're just going to sell these rather than invent them and make them.
Yeah, I can't remember. Maybe it was the plant in Oregon, he said, was making 10% of the chips they made were good and able to be sold. And then I was like, well, wait, that means the other 90% are not good? Right. And he's like, yes, that's not good. Right. Yeah.
Intel made a decision not to pursue aggressively AI, and that's probably what hurt it. It got delisted from NASDAQ last year, and they've just been sort of in trouble since then.
All right. Well, we'll see what develops with Intel. This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. We're talking with Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com, Sarah Donaldson with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Julie Carsmyth from the Associated Press. All right. We're going to move on to redistricting. Redistricting efforts are underway nationwide as Republicans move to lock down control of the U.S. House during the midterm elections. The Trump administration is pushing for favorable maps in Texas and Indiana, and has threatened to use the FBI to retrieve Texas Democrats who have bolted instead of voting on a congressional map there. And then Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom of California has also threatened to redraw maps in his state to add more Democrats. So, Julie, where does Ohio fit into all of this at the redistricting effort?
Well, what's different about us is that we are compelled to redraw our maps this year because of the system that's in our Constitution that said the last map needed to have bipartisan support in order to last for the full 10 years. So the maps get redrawn every 10 years on years that end in a one based on new census numbers. And ours was only good for a part of that time. So they have to come back to the table. Will they try to benefit Republicans even more than they already have? And, you know, I think probably yes, because of the climate that Trump is creating and the pressure he's putting on the states. They really want to win the Congress. They're feeling maybe their base is a little bit soft because of some of the actions that have happened out here in the hinterlands, in the middle of the country. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the idea is that they would use these maps to guarantee more seats.
When's the deadline for drawing the map?
For us, it's November 30th. There are certain interim deadlines in there, but it should start with the legislature. And again, if it can get bipartisan support, then that would be the end of it. But if it doesn't, it gets kicked to the redistricting commission again, and on and on we go.
What our listeners can't see is, as Julie said, if it gets bipartisan support, she smiled. So, well, do you expect it? Do you think there is a map we can draw that can get bipartisan support?
Well, I mean, certainly there is a map that could get bipartisan support, but whether it'll ever be introduced as a bill remains to be seen. I mean, the existing map was rejected. I mean, between the state house maps and the congressional maps, they were rejected 7 times by the Ohio Supreme Court. They were declared unconstitutional, improperly benefiting one party, being the Republicans who drew them. You know, as we all recall, they rejected that idea that they were unconstitutional and called the court rigged. And we are under those maps right now.
Are we redrawing just congressional maps?
Yes.
Or all the maps?
Yes, just congressional.
Just congressional. So what my state house rep and my state senator will stay the same.
Right. And that's because Ohio lawmakers were able to come to a bipartisan vote in 2023 on the state house.
That's forever
maps.
Ago.
I know, right? So all 7 lawmakers on the redistricting commission, including the 2 Democrats, Allison Russo and Nikki Antonio, they did vote for the state house map. So those maps stay.
Now, there are certain people that appear to be being targeted just because they come up in speeches made by J.D. Vance and Bernie Moreno, and it's Amelia Sykes and Marcy Kaptur.
You got to look at the numbers there, too, though. I mean, Marcy Kaptur won by less than a percentage, or maybe 1%. She won her race in 2024, and Amelia Sykes only won by 2%. So those were tight races. Truly, they could have turned out the other way. We could be under a 12-3 map if Republicans had won in those 2 districts, in those 2 tight races. I don't know that Republicans intended for these maps to be 10 Republicans and 5 Democrats. That's
no, I don't think so. I think that they tried to make those competitive, those 2 districts, and the Democrats held them.
Yeah, and I can never remember exactly where Amelia Sykes's district is versus
Akron.
Akron. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Laura, that's more Cleveland's neck of the woods. What's going on up there with talking about whether they can stay in office.
Well, she has the same competitor as she had last time because he came in so close. And the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee is hardcore fundraising and campaigning for him. And so we shall see. It's going to probably continue to be a close race. Yeah. I mean, you don't hear, for instance, like down here, Joyce Beatty is the Democrat. And I don't even know if there's a Republican running against her. If there is one, it's nobody high profile. They're not investing a dime in that race, the National Republican Party. However, Sykes and then also Marcy Kaptur are in the most vulnerable. And then you do have a somebody going against Greg Landsman down in Cincinnati. So, however, I don't know if that person has a background. That person, I think, does not have a background in politics. So I don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting about Amelia Sykes because she's native of Akron. Both of her parents have been in politics forever. It's sort of this political dynasty. Her dad is a veteran Ohio senator. Her mother has run for statewide office. And so she's a well-known name up there. The other thing about the residency of that whole region is the minute you start trying to add Republicans to her district, you might be putting Democrats in Max Miller's district. Hmm. And Max Miller, if you recall, is the former son-in-law of U.S. Senator Bernie Moreno. He worked in the Trump White House and, you know, was kind of brought in to replace Anthony, the one who had voted in favor of the impeachment of
I can't
Donald
remember
Trump.
The name.
Gonzalez.
Gonzalez.
Oh, there we go. It's,
yeah.
Yes. It's
and
like,
so
it's like
there's
name
a
that
lot
guy.
Of interesting. I mean, if you picture the map of Ohio from basically Akron on up through Canton, Cleveland, on up, it's very urban and tends to be very Democratic. So they could, if they draw her district in such a way, you know, she may turn around and run for statewide office, and that might not be what they want.
And on top of that, you've heard, you know, there's a lot of talk at the national level and there's a lot of national pressure coming down from the Trump administration. It sounds like not just in Ohio. I mean, obviously the focus is Texas right now. You've heard talk of some Republicans wanting a 13-2 map. So that would, that third district would be Greg Landsman's district. Flipping that to Republican
in Cincinnati.
Cincinnati. But Julie brings up a good point again. And because of our laws surrounding congressional lines and state house lines, you can't, especially with congressional maps, you have to keep Cincinnati intact. So you have to somehow draw Cincinnati into a Republican district. So there's a lot of dynamics going on, but you definitely hear this pressure for this want for a 12-3 or a 13-2 map. And again, two of the races were incredibly competitive and they were won by Democrats. So it remains to be seen how that would turn out in 2026 under different maps.
Yeah, one thing that fascinates me in terms of the debate is that we saw it firsthand here in Ohio. All the things we're talking about, like packing and cracking, trying to keep communities together, trying to keep cities together, these are the rules that underlie making political maps. You want them to be fair, and you're talking about communities. You're not necessarily talking about partisan affiliation, but it can tend to look that way because if you've got a city or an urban area, it's going to have more Democrats. So what we saw happen in Ohio last time is that those very rules were then turned around and described as gerrymandering when they defeated the redistricting issue last year. They basically said, well, look, we're just drawing the lines to favor Democrats rather than drawing the lines to favor Republicans, and it's all gerrymandering. And the Ohio Supreme Court said, yeah, that is gerrymandering. So for your listeners to understand, is gerrymandering is to sort of improperly go outside those rules to favor one party over the other.
But no matter which way you draw the line, it's like you're favoring a party. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the interesting thing, because of course you get into racial gerrymandering, which is illegal. It's illegal to draw districts based on like a district's racial makeup. Mm-hmm. But partisan gerrymandering is fully like legal. There are obviously, you know, laws in place to maybe try and prevent that in some states. It depends on the state. But there's nothing like from the U.S. Supreme Court that says you can't draw districts based on partisan makeup.
All right, before we take a break, I want to tell you about an event WOSU has coming up. It's called Politics and a Pint. From the never-ending talk of the governor's race to complaining about high property taxes to the Intel plant being in trouble again. Sometimes you need an adult beverage to understand Ohio politics, and that's why we are hosting another Politics and a Pint. You can join me, plus Columbus on the Record host Mike Thompson will be there, and a couple of State House vets will discuss all things Ohio politics. It's Thursday, August 21st at 6 at 7th Sun Brewing on North 4th Street. To register, go to WOSU.org/events. Coming up on our reporter roundtable, we're going to talk about Haitian migrants in Springfield, and then we are going to talk about how J.D. Vance has been making a lot of news lately, oddly enough related to river water levels. That is when All Sides Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides, and this is our weekly reporter roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, we have Sarah Donaldson, a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com, and Julie Carr Smythe, state government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. And Julie, you recently wrote about Haitians in Springfield. They're preparing for possible deportation. Many of them are here under temporary protected status, which President Biden expanded during his administration. But President Trump is now planning to end that status. So catch us up on where we stand and what preparations are being made.
So TPS, temporary protected status, was supposed to expire here very soon, like August 1st or something. And I think due to a court ruling, it has been extended somewhat a few months. So what we found out down there is that a big contingent of local folks are working with the Haitian community, with a lot of the religious institutions and some of the activist groups, and they're doing trainings to try to be ready so that when these Haitians, we'll remember that about 15,000 Haitians have kind of moved to that small city in a short period of time, and it became this kind of flashpoint during the presidential election with some misinformation about them eating their pets. These folks are trying to meet and understand what are the immigration laws, how can we set up networks so that if these folks get grabbed off the street, we can maybe provide them some support at their ICE appointment, or in the event they have to leave their homes or something like that, where can they be housed, this kind of thing. So, and I think that the governor, to some extent, has been trying to be supportive there, because he's very supportive of the Haitian community and has talked about how the workers there were really beneficial to the Ohio companies.
Do you feel that, you said it was about 15,000 Haitians in Springfield. Did you get the sense that they feel like someday, at some point in the next couple of months, they'll just be like this huge, I don't want to say they're going to raid the city, but I guess that's the word. I don't know.
I don't think anyone knows what to expect, really. I mean, things on that are just moving so quickly. You know, we're seeing aggressive efforts by the federal government, and then we're also seeing courts stopping some of that. And so by the time this expires, one court did allow it to continue, I think, through the fall. So, you know, by the time this expires, we're finding a lot of people are just moving back to their home country or moving to another country. And so the companies that were employing them are having to deal with that. And they had just been trying in the opposite way to try to build a bunch of programming around that with Haitian Creole translators and more help with the police and the traffic, because they don't really know how to drive. And in a lot of cases and are not required to have a driver's license to come here and things like that. So they had been working on
Laura.
That.
My understanding is that the Biden administration wanted them to be here through February 3 of next year at least, and that the Trump administration would like them out, I think, by like September 5. And so the courts have kind of delayed some of what Trump is doing. It's not just Haitians. There's 500,000 Haitians in the United States. Of course, like around 10 to 15,000 in Springfield, and then some in Columbus, too. But then you have people also from other countries. There's like 17 countries, I believe. So like Lebanon, Syria, Nicaragua, Venezuela, you know, just a lot of the troubled spots in the world, I think, maybe South Sudan, you know.
Right.
Just...
Well, and what we've seen is that the administration, Vance, even in particular, has described during the presidential campaign, temporary protected status is... still, they believe that these people were still illegal, that mm-hmm. Biden had basically used his executive power to make illegal immigrants legal, and that they don't believe in that program in principle, is how I understand it. But they're having some trouble getting it unraveled.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance there because they're saying that they only want to deport people who are here illegally. But if you disagree on which programs are legal and illegal, then how do you decide?
You heard a lot from now Senator Bernie Moreno on the campaign trail as well about this, that he thought that temporary protective status should be used in very, very small cases, and that temporary should mean much more temporary than it's been in a lot of these mm-hmm. cases, because some of these countries have been under TPS for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think for Haiti in particular, the governor is very familiar there because he runs a charity there that's a school named for his daughter. I don't know its current status because that island is so torn apart by strife and gang leadership and hurricanes and everything else. And so, but he respects the troubles in Haiti on a very personal level.
Yeah, he's traveled to Haiti. I mean, not recently, but I feel like he's been there several times.
The administration's arguing that the Trump administration, that they can go back to Haiti because it's safe now. However, that's obviously just a tactic, because if you go to the State Department website and look up if you should travel to Haiti, the answer is obviously no. So that's just kind of what they're saying as a tactic, because they want them to go back.
All right, we'll have to keep an eye on that. Maybe keep an eye on the September 5th date. The date keeps moving, basically.
Right.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Julie Carr Smythe from the Associated Press, Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com, and Sarah Donaldson from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Vice President J.D. Vance keeps making news, and not always for the reasons he may like. He returned to Ohio the other week to tout the president's budget bill. And he also addressed the brawl in Cincinnati in late July that went viral and became a GOP talking point about crime and violence and lawlessness. And then finally, his birthday kayaking trip on the Little Miami River stirred up some controversy. Julie, you've been covering all of these developments. Do you have a favorite J.D. Vance story from the past week?
Well, the story of the Secret Service raising the level of the Little Miami River ahead of his birthday kayaking trip is that's got to be a winner.
Yeah, yeah.
And so basically they said they knew nothing about it, and I did find out that...
The Vance people.
Right,
knew
they did not know they were going to raise the level. The reason they did that, according to the Secret Service, is that they have motorized boats and things like that that they need to be in to follow him and protect him. So that small river wouldn't have been up high enough. As I understand it, even some kayakers have trouble getting through on certain days because it's just not that big of a river. So the Corps of Engineers was asked by the Secret Service, and they raised the level for that day. But again, the Vance...
it's so powerful to say J.D. Vance controls the rivers.
That's right. And they did say they didn't know anything about it. And I did dig up a case where Al Gore, back in 1999, when he was vice president and was running for office, the Connecticut River was raised ahead of a photo op that he had. And again, he said he knew nothing about it. The Secret Service took the hit on that and said we needed to raise it so we could protect
him. So Al Gore controls the internet and the rivers. Okay.
The criticism is coming from people who point out all the cuts to the National Park Service, all the cuts to, you know, BLM and other organizations that are involved in conservation. And so you don't even have employees responding if you need like a hunting permit these days, but yet they can raise the water for the vice president. So that's kind of what, you know, the criticism is coming from.
Those Secret Service members need to just learn how to kayak, it seems like, right? They could just protect him on a kayak instead of needing a motorized boat. They wouldn't need as much water.
I have no comment on that, Amy.
No, okay. That's my comment. I don't know. I could see how if the vice president fell out of a kayak and the Secret Service needed to save him, they need to get there quickly, right? I get
right,
that.
Or his children and wife were with him as well. So
yeah.
As far as I know. And you get that it's... You know, he's in the public eye. He's in a very important office. Sometimes he's going to do things like want a kayak or go to a wedding or something that's personal. And just, you know, it is what it is. He can deal with the politics part of it. I just know that's what happened.
Okay. Well, yeah, I guess we'll leave it there. There's more. We could just keep talking about the river for a while. But he also... was talking about major cities. Recently, he had a speech, and he started talking about major cities, including Columbus and Cincinnati, having lawlessness. And this is related to July 26th. A fight broke out between black and white individuals in downtown Cincinnati. It went viral with snippets of the video, not the full context of what happened. So why did this spark so much national outrage? Sarah, what's your take on J.D. Vance getting involved in a viral video out of Cincinnati?
I think you do have a situation here, and maybe I'm going to draw a bigger conclusion here. You have a situation where Ohio is, again, sometimes in the national spotlight just by nature of who is representing us in Washington, because the vice president is from Ohio, because Vivek Ramaswamy, who is running for governor, has a national profile and has been in the Trump orbit. So I think sometimes, you know, folks are going to call out an issue one way or another. If they see it as political, it's going to touch them a little more closely if it's close to home. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, maybe if this had happened in another city, it would have caught the same level of attention. But you saw it with Springfield, and you've also seen it with Cincinnati now. And I mean, I can think of, you know, a city in Colorado that went through the same situation as Springfield. And I'm sure there have been similar situations to Cincinnati. But that is just a general note that I do think we have a lot of high-level Republicans who come from Ohio who often are going to maybe be a little more quick to call out something as political and see it as political when it's in their own cities. It's been a tough case in Cincinnati. I mean, I've not followed it as closely as maybe I know Julie's done some coverage on it, but just really like heightened tensions there. And especially I know there's been a lot of frustration thrown at the Cincinnati police department, particularly the police chief. I've seen some Republicans, you know, complaining that she said the full context wasn't there. But sometimes with these viral incidents, and I'm not specifically commenting on this incident, like you said, Amy, we only have part of the video and we weren't there in the moment. And that is the backside to social media. No one, you know, obviously, I don't think women should be sucker punched and thrown to the ground. I think that's pretty like objectively horrible, no matter how you slice it. But as it comes with the racial tensions as part of this video, like you just... most of us don't have the context.
Well, and Vice President J.D. Vance, as I mentioned, was at a recent event in Canton, and he was asked about the incident, and he conceded that he didn't, at that moment, he hadn't seen the entire video. Here's what he said when he was in Canton.
How many of you all have wanted to go to downtown Akron or downtown Canton or downtown Columbus for a meal, but you're worried because the local authorities in these big cities have allowed lawlessness to run wild? We have got to make great American cities safe again.
Yeah. So, Julie, what do you make of comments like that? It sounds like J.D. Vance is trying to scare people.
This is definitely going to be a Republican theme. I can feel it coming. In addition to Vivek Ramaswamy and Vance being from not only Ohio, but from Cincinnati, J.D.'s brother is running for mayor of Cincinnati as a Republican in a runoff type election. They don't have partisan primaries. But what I think is that, yeah, they're trying to paint that. We're seeing just today, you know, he's Trump is doing the same thing with the city of Washington, D.C., as a way of almost like, we need to take over the city and bring law and order back. So it's really interesting. And what we've seen is incredible pushback from, for example, the mayor of Cincinnati, Aftab Pervall, has said, you know, we're reducing a lot of our major crimes. We saw a front page story in the Columbus Dispatch saying, I don't know what you're saying about Columbus, but our crime is down. Crime is at record, is down record levels in D.C. Akron, Canton, he mentioned those. Obviously, he was there, but also because they're targeting Amelia Sykes. So it's going to be a theme. Not that they're inaccurate, that there's crime in big cities and that should be addressed. But, you know, it's a partisan debate of how you go about doing that.
This has gone back all the way to John Kasich when he cut the local government fund in half. And so kind of hamstrung cities and how they make their funding priorities. And this is going on all over the country. Most cities are blue. Most states, numerically, most states are red. And then you can say that the Democratic-run cities are lawless. But like a lot of states are cutting funding to them. So, this is just kind of, this has been going on for a long time now.
The last J.D. Vance note that I'll say is that Vance did poke fun at South Park's latest episode, which poked fun at him. He posted on X and said, well, I finally made it. And he shared an image of President Trump and himself as characters from the TV show Fantasy Island in South Park. So he was featured in South Park. I mean, he's of the proper age where he probably was a South Park fan. So he probably was excited to be on South Park a little bit, even though they made fun of him.
Yeah, I thought it was. Really great and telling that he's a millennial and he just sort of rolled with it. I mean, these were brutal episodes against the Trump administration, but you know, then you can just be like, hey, I was on South Park, you know?
Yes. Yeah, so he wrote, he finally made it, which yes. And I haven't watched South Park in a long time, but he's of the right age that he would have enjoyed the first few seasons.
You guys were talking about J.D. Vance falling out of a kayak and I was kind of laughing because I was thinking about when he dropped the national championship trophy.
Yes.
And I do feel like you got to give him credit. Like, I feel like he really does roll with the punches on some of those. Like, J.D. Vance has been the subject of so many memes since the 2024 election. He really seems to roll with the punches when it comes to that.
That's true. I forgot all about him dropping the trophy. How could I forget?
As soon as you said falling out of a kayak, it like appeared in my brain very visually.
Yes.
The reason I'm sort of intrigued by the South Park thing is that this was coming amid the whole merger between Paramount and CBS. And, you know, they had canceled the Stephen Colbert show. He's on that network. Jon Stewart, apparently Comedy Central, is also part of the Paramount Network, and he's been really then critical of them canceling his old friend Stephen Colbert. And then apparently what had happened with South Park is that they had secured their new contract about 2 weeks before the merger, and so it said that they have free reign and whatever, so they may be the one to watch right now.
Yeah,
they can't get fired.
Nobody should have given South Park free reign of anything. I think that was a bad call. All right, well, coming up, we're going to talk about how Ohio lawmakers want to give students mental health days. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, we have Sarah Donaldson, a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com, and Julie Carr-Smythe, state government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Laura, your colleague Anna Staver did a deep dive into the history of property taxes in the state. She found that local governments, especially schools, are leaning harder on residential property taxes to fund the same services that they used to. So, what did we find out about how the state contribution has declined?
Okay, so in 1999, the average school district in Ohio, 47%, so almost 50%, 47% of their revenues came from state sources. Today, this year, it is down to 38%, so it's 9% lower. And then because of changes made in the budget, it's projected in 2027 to go down to 32%. So you're going from almost half to a third. And so basically, the result of that means that school districts are having to rely more and more on property taxes. And then you have this problem where you have, houses have, the value of houses have gone up a lot. Inflation since, I think, 2018 is up about a third. Prices of everything are up a third. And so that means, like, the cost of pencils, of laptops, of everything that a school district is going to purchase is up. And so they need more money. And yet there's less money coming in from the state. So then they're going to the ballot and asking for, levies and, bonds. And it just kind of depends on the district. Some districts reject them. Some districts accept them. But you're just kind of seeing them become more and more dependent on the property tax. There used to be a tax called the tangible personal property tax. And that was charging businesses on equipment and machinery. And of course, that's important because manufacturing is like one of our big industries here in Ohio. That went away, I believe, during maybe around Kasich. And then for a while, there was a period where school districts were still getting some money from the state, not from that tax, obviously, because it went away, but just some cash to sort of like make up for that loss. But then that ended. And so that's another revenue stream that they lost from the state. So, so it's just become, now the lawmakers say school districts are spending too much on overhead. There's too many, all these salaries of these administrators are too high. And also when you look at the number of children, the number of children, there's fewer children in Ohio because people, our state's getting older. People are having fewer children just, in Ohio and nationally. And so you don't have, where maybe before you had around, 2 million kids, you're now down to about 1.6 million in the public schools. And so people are saying, the schools need to right size. And if you look at like Columbus City School District, yeah, they're closing some schools, but they pared back significantly the number of schools that they were going to close. So there is something to be said for that. But then, you can't underestimate what the state has done for like the last 40 years in terms of just cutting what goes to school districts.
Right. And another piece of the enrollment puzzle is that we've radically expanded the amount of opportunities to charter schools, homeschools, mm-hmm. religious schools, and given some public money to those entities for various reasons. So that's a piece of it as well. Interestingly, the legislature did come back in and they were able to veto one of the most, the thing that they're bugged by the most, which is these replacement and renewal levies, which mm-hmm. The people who oppose those just feel like those are not understood by the public, and that those two words make people think that they're just simply replacing what they've already always done, and that's not quite how it works. I'm not going to tell you exactly how it works because
property taxes, property values are more, so it's not an exact replacement. It's just the same percentage, but the amount is higher. So,
right. So
you are giving more money.
Right.
Right.
But what they weren't able to do in the legislature was this, this thing where they wanted to cut the amount of reserves that the districts could have. The lawmakers just have dollar signs in their eyes over that money because mm-hmm. they're obviously trying to cut costs, cut taxes, that kind of thing. And they've got a lot of money collectively, not, you know, not that districts are one entity. They each are individual government entities, but collectively they have a lot of money in the bank, which they might be saving for construction or for a rainy day like this where they can't, where they need to make up more of their budget with their own local money.
Yeah, Sarah, we've spent many a roundtable discussing property taxes. I feel like I've taken like a crash course, Property Taxes 101, and I still don't understand it all. But
me neither. Trust yeah. me. We're all learning together.
But the bottom line is property taxes are too high. And then the state is not giving many entities, not just schools, enough money. And so they say they have to go to the ballot. And this is the only option they have.
Well, and I think that the legislature would counter you there and mm-hmm. say that they're investing in schools more and more each year because mm-hmm. the pure dollar sign number is going up. Now, whether that can truly fund the cost to educate a student is another question. But there's certainly bubbling frustration among property owners of all ages. And, you know, property taxes don't just affect property owners. They affect renters, too, because property owners then pass those costs on to renters. There's certainly a bubbling frustration. And of course, you know, it should be mentioned that there is this effort out here, grassroots effort, to put an amendment on the ballot to completely abolish property taxes. Whether that has the gumption to move is another question. It's really hard to get on the ballot. But my colleague, Karen Kassler, sat down with one of the spokespeople for the group last week. And he told her that even if the legislature makes moves toward property tax reforms in some way, they're still going to pursue this amendment. Mm. And I think lawmakers, you know, maybe tried to spring into action during the budget cycle, in part because they felt spooked by the fact that, I mean, if this makes the ballot, I don't think I'm incorrect in saying that there will be a very resounding effort to defeat it mm-hmm. coming from all sides. Democrats don't want property taxes abolished. I don't think the average Republican in office wants property taxes abolished because property taxes fund schools, but they also fund local municipalities in other ways, like police forces. And, you know, I mean, you will see.
Water districts.
So did Karen, yeah. when Karen interviewed the person in charge of this campaign, is he or she, are they nonpartisan or what?
I couldn't tell you what mm-hmm. his partisan affiliation yeah. is. You do hear the groups who are pushing for this and the folks who I've heard push for it most tend to lean pretty far to the right. Mm-hmm. But it just depends. I mean, there are libertarians, of course, who don't believe in this idea of taxation. And again, I think from the Republicans in office, there are a lot of Republicans who are looking to Vivek Ramaswamy to potentially cut the income tax completely. Mm-hmm. You can't eliminate all taxes and still have a functioning government.
We won't
and
have any money.
Society.
Right.
That's just like basic government. But all that to say, I do think it's interesting that this group, you know, is not really being swayed by the legislature one way or another. And of course, on top of this bubbling property tax amendment and whatever lawmakers are doing, and like Julie said, lawmakers weren't quite able to get much done in the veto override session. They overrode one of Governor DeWine's vetoes. DeWine vetoed several other property tax items and they just weren't able to get the number of votes in the House because they intended to vote on three. Mm-hmm. They only voted on one and they didn't even try to vote on the one that Julie was talking about with the carryover cash.
Right.
And the one that the House has overridden still has to go through the Senate. So right. we don't even know that that will be overridden.
And I have heard that, you know, the Senate has the votes. They're kind of just, you know, waiting
for people to get back from vacation. Yeah.
Yeah. But all that to say, on top of all this, the governor has also established a working group to look at property taxes. So it's a lot of we're looking at this, we're talking about different solutions, but certainly it's been the same for however long we've been talking about property taxes. Nothing has really passed yet. There's nothing been done.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes left, but Laura, a new school year is upon us and there are changes afoot with K-12 schools. The Trump administration reversed course when it comes to some of the K-12 funding. Mm-hmm. You wrote about that. Can you just give us a 2-minute update?
They were being sued by a bunch of teachers unions in Democratic states for withholding around $7 billion with a B in funding to the states. And this paid for like after school after-school programs, academic after-school programs, teacher and educator professional development, migrant English learning, things like that. They were holding it because they were reviewing it, but they got sued by the Democrats. But they also got sued by, or they also got a pressure from rural Republicans, and so then they released the money. And so a bunch is coming to Ohio. The details. It's going to be about the same as last year, I think, is my understanding. So, yeah, and this will be good news for programs in Ohio that desperately need this money.
All right. Well, we're going to end it there. And I want to once again invite our listeners to Politics and a Pint, whether it's talk of the governor's race, property taxes, or the Intel plant. Sometimes you need an adult beverage to understand Ohio politics. So we're inviting you to Politics and a Pint. You can join me, Columbus on the Record host Mike Thompson, and a couple of State House vets. We'll discuss all things politics. It is Thursday, August 21st at 6 at 7th Sun Brewing on North 4th Street. Register at WOSU.org/events. And I want to say thank you to Julie Carr Smythe, state government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks for being here, Julie.
Yeah, thanks for having me. We have one breaking news that the property tax was actually eliminated in 2006 under Taft.
Okay. Taft did it, not whoever. Got it. And then Sarah Donaldson, a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Status News Bureau. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks.
And Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks, Laura.
It's been fun.
And this is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.